Hello and welcome to another edition of Film Weekly. I'm Jason Solomons, and this week I'm joined by the legendary Danny Glover to discuss African cinema. I meet Hollywood's number one slimy Frenchman, Vincent Cassel, and we get ready for Oscar night with special guests TV presenter Sarah Kaywood and Zan Brooks, film editor of Guardian Unlimited. As well as the usual reviews and prize competition, that's all to come on Film Weekly with me, Jason Solomons. We begin with the Oscars, the climax of the awards season, a long red carpet that leads all the way from the Golden Globes to the Oscars. It's time to put on the music, it's time to light the lights for the most sensational, celebrational night of the film year. And to preview that event, I got in a glamorous showbiz huddle with TV star Sarah Kaywood and Zan Brooks, who'll be up all night during the Oscars reporting minute by minute for the Guardian website. Sunday night is Oscar night in Hollywood and all over the world. The red carpets are being laid out. The Oscar statuettes are being dusted up to a high sheen. We here at Film Weekly are doing the same. We have our glad rags on. We have glamorous co-presenters for Oscar night. We have Sarah Kaywood.
Hello.
Thank you, Sarah, for coming on to Film Weekly. We have Zan Brooks, editor of online Guardian Film Online.
Hello.
Zan, let's start with you. Because you're the least glamorous of all of us. Oscars is big business across the world. It isn't just a US phenomenon. We're kind of obsessed with them here too.
Yeah, I mean, there's the presumption is that the Oscars are this kind of Hollywood backslapping session. But in fact, they're a massive Hollywood marketing session. You know, films that do well at the Oscars get a huge kind of push afterwards. The box office goes rocketing. If they're coming out on DVD, obviously kind of boost sales then. And that's, you know, the bottom line. It's a kind of dollar industry.
And, you know, you watch the Oscars, you'll see all the ladies go up, the men go up to collect their awards. But in the meantime, they show huge clips of them in action, which are massive. Promotions.
Yeah, they're fantastic showreels. They're also kind of walking advertisements for whatever designers manage to kind of throw a bit of expensive fabric over them. It kind of works on a number of marketing levels.
So for a film head, is the Oscars an excitement or a distraction?
I think it's both, isn't it? I think it's one of those things that we always get very kind of sniffy about it. But the fact that we're sniffy about it shows that we're actually kind of really involved in the soap opera of the Academy race.
Sarah, as someone who follows the celebrity world very closely, and indeed is one.
Loosely speaking.
does this time of year excite you for the Oscars? And in which way? Is it because of the frocks, or is it because you're gonna kind of see some films that you perhaps should be seeing over the next 6 months?
I think it's a little bit of both, actually. I mean, I really do get excited about, you know, who's swanning up the red carpet wearing what. And you just know they're starving themselves as we speak. That's it. No more carbs for the rest of the week. This year, I've got a bit of a vested interest because one of my mates is going over to cover it for Sky. So I'm looking forward to seeing
who's
her
that?
Do it. That's Fern Cotton. She's doing it for Sky. And also, for me personally, I'm not necessarily a film buff. I am a movie goer. I'm a punter. And for me, it's a really great advert for what I might go rent on DVD or see at the cinema next.
Yeah. I mean, it's true, because as a film professional, I've seen all these films sometimes in advance before the nominations come out. And the nominations have been sort of out and in the atmosphere for the sort of last sort of 6 weeks. But of course, most people won't have seen these films. Mm-hmm. I mean, many of them are not even available yet. Half Nelson, which Ryan Gosling is nominated for Best Actor, is not out here till April. I mean, I've seen that. But most of these films have only just recently kind of hit the big screen. Mm-hmm. So will you kind of watch the Oscars and sort of say, do you know what, I really fancy that after seeing the clips?
Yeah, absolutely. That'll be what reels me in. But also, I think for me, because I tend to watch a lot of films at home on DVD, and I like to talk about a film after I've watched it. And so if I'm on my own, that really colours what I'll watch. So there'll be some things, like I think I was mentioning earlier about Babel, that looks quite heavy. Probably have to save that for a mate, you know, watch that with a mate. But then Little Miss Sunshine I watched on my own the other day. It was an absolute joy.
Yeah, exactly. Well, a little bit, it's interesting that you mentioned Little Miss Sunshine, because I think that could be one of the big surprises of Oscar night. It was a surprise already that it's got a nomination for Best Picture. And it seems to me that that's a very open race at the moment, Zan. I don't know if you've got any online betting scams that you've been
involved with. Well, yeah, the Best Picture race is probably the most open it's been in years. I think maybe four of the five films stand a legitimate chance of winning, and I think it probably comes down to the kind of Scorsese swingometer. It's like the kind of Peter Snow swingometer on Oscar night. But Scorsese is heavily tipped to win the Best Director award.
Every year?
Every year. But he hasn't done it yet, has
more
he?
So, more so this year. He's been nominated. This is his sixth nomination. Traditionally, the Best Director award goes hand in hand with the Best Picture. It's very rare for them to split it. In which case, you'd have to say The Departed, the Scorsese film, will win Best Picture. And yet Little Miss Sunshine seems to be kind of coming up on the inside a little bit. It surprised people already, as you say. Babel also maybe stands a sort of slight chance to win too.
Yeah, Sarah mentioned Babel just before. It's got 7 nominations. It's a hugely fancied picture in a way, but nominations for the actresses in supporting roles, Adriana Barraza and Rinko Kikuchi. It's also nominated, as you say, for Best Picture. This is a movie that Sarah said she's seen clips of, and we're going to see a lot of clips of it over Oscar night. And as you say, Sarah, you think it looks a bit heavy.
Oh, it looks really quite bleak. It just doesn't... I mean, obviously, it's important that you do see films like that.
No, it's not. In this case, it's
really?
It's not.
Is
no,
it? Okay, so is this not a recommendation,
no,
then, Dan? You're saying don't bother.
It's twaddle. It's kind of... It's very handsome-looking, and it kind of works up to a point, but it's... I think it's totally empty-headed in the end of the day.
Right.
But... cynically, I think it's a film that will play very well to the Academy voters. It's mm-hmm. it's a little bit similar to Crash last year,
right.
That it's a film that makes them feel that they're honouring a film that tackles big issues and makes them feel very kind of serious and proud of themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
I also think it's a very puffed up movie, but as you say, this is the danger of the Oscars, of seeing the Oscars as emblematic of film culture. We kind of watch Oscar night, you think, cool, that looks good, and Brad Pitt all mm-hmm. this, but it must have kind of a badge of quality about it. Is there a sense that you can hype things so much that the Oscars become, in a way, a sort of lie or an empty sham, Sam?
I think that's probably true, and I think that happened with Crash last year. Crash came out in the summer of 2005 in the UK. It got kind of pretty good reviews. It was seen as a decent-ish movie. It kind of snuck up behind Brokeback Mountain, which was the heavy favourite going in last year, to win Best Picture. And suddenly everybody was kind of having to reappraise it. It suddenly became a great film of the last couple of mm-hmm. years, which in a way that it had not been seen before and probably didn't really merit being seen as.
So, Sarah, have you been in LA at Oscar time?
I have. Couple of times, actually.
Excellent.
I've managed that. And we all, literally, it's fab over there because everybody has Oscar parties.
Mm.
I mean, and you talk through all the kind of, no disrespect to these people, but all the boring stuff. And, you know, it's all about best movie, best director, you know, best actor, actress. And it's just really, really, get takeout. You know,
isn't it like really feudal though? Is there like a kind of hierarchy of Oscar parties that you know, if I was there, I'd probably be invited to the real worst one. The kind
what, you
of
mean,
one with
what,
paper
the
cups
Oscar
and...
watching party?
Yeah.
Oh Christ, I'm just at my mate's house.
Oh right, oh, fine. Yeah. Oh well, then
I'm not at the Soho House in the Hills that they set up for the week before Oscar night. You know.
But this is the thing in America; it is the second most watched TV event of the year.
Is it really?
The Super Bowl is the number one, and then the Oscars is supposed to be the next one. You can gauge the popularity of the ceremony by the mm-hmm. films that are nominated for Best Picture. The year that Titanic won, they had their biggest audience for the last 10 years because everyone wanted to see if Titanic was going to
yeah.
win.
Mm.
So if you got a film like Crash, which no one went to see last year, they were criticised for having kind of a boring lineup. What do you think this year that the interest will be?
Well, this year there probably aren't many obvious blockbusters in the best film category. I mean, Babel, you're talking about the difference between Cannes and Oscars. Babel was in competition at Cannes last year, which implies that the Oscars are trying to kind of get slightly more highbrow, that they maybe aren't chasing ratings in the way that they maybe have in the past. You know, The Departed did very, very well.
But and it's got Leonardo DiCaprio.
And it's got Leonardo DiCaprio.
The Titanic
but, you know, the Queen didn't do that well. I mean, it's a small film, so it's never going to have a huge wide release. So I think that they're doing the similar thing to they did last year, really. They're kind of having these slightly smaller prestige movies.
And foreign language. In the best picture, we've got Letters from Iwo Jima, which is in Japanese, not out here yet, coming up this weekend. And Babel, which is half in Moroccan Arabic and half in Japanese.
Yeah, and you've got Penelope Cruz nominated as Best Actress for Volver, which is a Spanish language film. So, you know, they're I don't know, maybe you could make this big sort of political point that maybe they're trying, America is trying to show that it doesn't end with Hollywood, that they're kind of embracing the
but
world
does,
in a way that
it.
The Bush administration maybe isn't, that they're paying lip service to the world
yeah.
at large.
Yeah, that
that's
there
what
is
it
a
is
word.
Though, isn't it? It's just lip service, really.
Is there anyone you're particularly looking forward to seeing it, Sarah? I mean,
what film?
No, as a personality, it becomes about a sort of, almost a battle for ratings, if you never know, almost
yeah.
an election race over this coming week, where Forrest Whitaker looks to me like he's got it all sewn up.
Yeah.
I'm not quite sure. I mean, Helen Mirren has been putting everything before her. Is there a chance that she might be tripped up on the final hurdle?
I hope not. I'm afraid I do. I get very patriotic at Oscar time. I love it when we go in there and take their awards away from them. Go, oh, we can do it just as well as you. And I really hope Helen Mirren does it. It really has been her year. And she's just the best ever. Also, Hollywood, famously, doesn't allow actresses to get old. they're not allowed to. And the woman is still fabulously sexy. She played the Queen, obviously, who's 80. She's probably about 20 years younger than that. I thought she looked the part. And then she'll show up on the red carpet looking absolutely drop-dead stunning.
I know, she still gets she still does a cleavage at the age of 61.
Yeah, she's fantastic. And I think she's flying the flag for the old woman in Hollywood. I really hope she wins.
And also, you know, honourable mention of Judi Dench as well, who's in there too.
Yeah.
From Next on a Scandal, who's fantastic.
I think she's really unlucky this year. Judi Dench has come up against Helen Mirren, because I think this is Judi Dench's best performance.
Oh, she's absolutely superb in it. And, you know, this is the downside of being an older woman in Hollywood. She's missing the Oscars because she's having a knee replacement operation.
Oh, bless her. Sure, she's not having a boob job, Zan.
Yeah, I'm saying nothing.
There's Meryl Streep in The Devil Wears Prada. Everyone's going to be, interestingly, you know, it's a film which kind of celebrates fashion. And, of course, the Oscars celebrate
fashion
themselves. So what's she going to be wearing on Oscar night? It's as big a question as it was in her movie.
I absolutely love Meryl Streep. She's brilliant in that film as well. She can do it all, can't she? She's a great comedy actress. She's a great dramatic actress. She's just, across the board, can turn her hand to anything, any accent, any role. She's brilliant.
Where would someone, Sarah, who wanted to kind of find out what fashion was like at the Oscars? Because we tend to get the kind of hours red carpet before, but then you kind of have to sit through 4.5 hours of thank you speeches. Where does one look for what people were wearing?
I think the best is the American magazine, the American Gossip magazine, like People magazine. So you could go to people.com. I would imagine that'll be up. I would love to see somebody walk up that red carpet in Miss Selfridge. I would pay good money
jeans
to see that.
Jeans and a t-shirt.
Jeans and a t-shirt. Do you know what I mean? Just buck the trend. It's all.
Do you think that there could be a rebel amongst them who might turn up and kind of and do what you're suggesting? Jeans and t-shirt.
The jeans and t-shirt. Oh, Sam Morton. She has been to the Oscars, hasn't she?
She was nominated for. She won. Sweet and Lowdown.
Oh right, okay.
The Woody Allen film.
Yeah, she absolutely does buck the trend. I see her down the Lot Tavern in Chalk Farm, and you know, she's always in jeans and t-shirt. You ain't getting that girl in a frock. So I'd like to see that. I'd like to see Sam Morton show up. Give Hollywood the finger.
Zan, I'm going to ask you for some predictions, which would make you look great because we can play these back and you'll look completely
stupid. Shame me. Well, I think Helen Mirren is the closest thing to a shoo-in for Best Actress. I think Scorsese is the closest thing to a shoo-in for Best Director.
You really think this?
I really think he will do it this year. It's nowhere near his best film. You know, he should have won it for Goodfellas. He should have won it for Raging Bull. But he didn't, so, you know, the Academy.
You know what beat him when Goodfellas won?
Was that Dancers with Wolves?
Yeah, that was Dancers
with Wolves. Was it really?
And Raging Bull?
Ordinary People.
Ordinary People. How often do
it's
we watch
crime.
Those now?
Exactly.
Crimes against cinema.
So I think this is his year. I don't know if The Departed will win Best Film as well. I kind of almost think Babel will win Best
really?
Film.
Really?
It hasn't been winning so much, though, has it?
I don't know.
I'd like to see Little Miss Sunshine win Best Film.
Well, I think Miss Sunshine, I would put some money on it.
That wouldn't surprise me either.
It's one of those ones that everyone's catching up on DVD because it was out in the sort of the summer and no one saw it. And it's also got quite a big cast as well. And I think
Alan Arkin will win Best Supporting Actor.
Ahead of Eddie Murphy in Dreamgirls.
I think so. I'm really going out on a limb. I'm going to look such an oaf.
No, not at all. I think it's a very open race this year, as you say. But I do think Forrest Whitaker's a shoe, and I can't see anyone.
I think the only person who might trip up.
And God save anyone who trips Forrest Whitaker up, I'd say.
That could hurt.
You don't trip either. I think Peter O'Toole may have a very slight chance for the sort of sentimental vote, but I agree. Forrest Whitaker's a heavy favourite.
Zan will, of course, be giving minute-by-minute blows of the Oscar ceremony on Guardian Online all through the night on Sunday. Sarah Kaywood can next be seen on your television screens presenting Comic Relief Does Fame Academy on March the 3rd. While films such as The Last King of Scotland and Blood Diamond mean Africa does have some representation at the Oscars, our next film, unfortunately, takes us worlds away from the LA Glitz Fest. Bamako is the latest work from Malian director Abderrahmane Sissako and is unlike anything you'll ever have seen before. Set in the courtyard of a small house in the Malian capital of the film's title, Sissako constructs a drama around an extraordinary mock trial with Africa as the plaintiff up against such Western world giants as the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank and entire governments who hold Africa to its debts. This isn't some evangelical rock star type plea. Sissako's film appeals to the heart and the mind, with silver-haired French magistrates fending off accusations from a variety of African characters, all of whom put their cases emotionally and persuasively. Sissako's camera fixes a steady, intense gaze at times, letting faces do as much talking as the script. But he also hovers around the courtyard like an insect, zooming into men listening to news of the trial on their transistor radios, picturing animals and ants, and following a hauntingly beautiful nightclub singer, played by Aisa Miyagi, as she gets ready and goes to work. Remarkably, after all the detail and the pleading, Sissako finally frustrates us and leaves us to make up our minds on this one, although there can be little doubt as to where our sympathies should lie. In a brief and rather surreal interlude during the film, there's a spaghetti western skit in which six cowboys have a shootout in an African village. It symbolises perhaps western exploitation as much as it does the long history of Africa's own corrupt and violent leadership. One of the cowboys is played by Danny Glover, the Lethal Weapon and Dreamgirls star who has, what many will find, a surprising executive producer's credit on this uniquely moving and powerful film. I sought him out for an explanation before the film's gala screening as part of the Renoir Cinema's Africa on Screen season.
Danny Glover, how fantastic to see you. Welcome to London.
Thank you very much. It's good to be here.
You just got off the plane.
Yeah, I just happened to be part of my life story right now, just getting off the plane. Getting somewhere, getting off the plane. But it's all right.
Yeah, I mean, you're here for the special screening, the premiere of Bamako.
Yeah,
Bamako. Which is a wonderful film, which I've enjoyed immediately. But Danny, what was it about a lack of African storytelling, a lack of funding for African films that made you want to support it at this time in your career?
This is a 20-year journey. When I finished Mandela 21 years ago, one of the things that I began to talk to people about is how can we support African film? Via film festival, I was a co-founder of a film festival in Los Angeles, the Pan-African Film Festival. I had come of age watching African films. Foreign films represent two things for me. One, because I'm dyslexic, so I get a chance to read. It's a funny thing that the first thing, and first time that when I went to a foreign film, it was a Scandinavian film, and I was about 17 years old. And the things that I'm looking at the subtitle, and also there's a kind of being able to read that, but also being able to see other people live outside the framework that I live in, out of the confines of my story.
You're currently obviously involved in Dreamgirls at the moment, which is a movie that has 8 Oscar nominations, and I'm sure you'll be back in Hollywood for the Oscars themselves. And we had Forest Whitaker just the other night winning a BAFTA for the Best Actress. Yeah. African stories and African American stories are very prominent at the moment, Danny. And you must be quite proud that you've had something to do with that. You fought for that prominence.
I don't know if we consider ourselves fighting for it. I mean, I've been involved in issues around African liberation and the anti-apartheid movement. Those are the things that I've been involved in over the last 30 years of my life, and I'm proud to have been a part of that. Whether what I did as a filmmaker made some sort of contribution to changing the attitude around African films, I'd say that's marginal. I say that's a reach, you know, but I know what I did do over the last 35 years of my life did in some way try to create awareness of what was happening in Africa politically.
Danny Glover's championing of foreign films there has perhaps had some effect already, as 2 subtitle films have made it into the Best Picture nominees at the Oscars. Babel, as we've already mentioned, is one of them, and Clint Eastwood's Letters from Iwo Jima is another, nominated somewhat strangely on its own rather than in conjunction with its partner film Flags of Our Fathers. Letters from Iwo Jima tells the story of the World War II battle for Mount Suribachi from the Japanese point of view, and almost entirely in Japanese. Eastwood focuses his story on Saigo, a simple baker who just wants to survive to see his newborn daughter, Baron Nishi, a former Olympic equestrian champion, Lieutenant Ito, a strict militarian, and General Kuribashi, played by Ken Watanabe of The Last Samurai fame, who's travelled extensively in America and whose tactics enable the Japanese to prolong the bloody battle. Iwo Jima is shot in the same bleached-out sepias as Flags of Our Fathers by Tom Stern, Eastwood's cinematographer on Million Dollar Baby and Mystic River. The two films even feature some of the same shots, but taken from different perspectives. The raising of the famous flag was central to the first film. Here, the event is seen only as a detail in one corner of a larger vista. I was an admirer of Flags of Our Fathers, a film I think that has been vastly underrated in the current awards season. Conversely, I think Letters from Iwo Jima is overrated, a dull piece with very little visual elan and a sanctimonious tone. Where Eastwood revealed a cynical, black heart to the American heroism of the first work, his desire to have us admire the Japanese addiction to duty and honour comes heavy-handedly here, making the film excessively noble and simplistically sentimental. There are, of course, some memorable scenes. How can anyone fail to be moved by the sight of soldiers pulling grenades and holding them to their own heads? But overall, the film lacks artistic tension, that sense of thrill you get when you feel a director is wrestling with moral dilemmas before your very eyes. Here, Clint's got it all worked out before we've even started, and boy, is he going to tell us what he thinks. Another actor branching out this week is Francis Vincent Cassel. He burst onto the scene in La Haine in 1995 and has appeared in French hits such as Crimson River, L'Appartement, on which he met his partner, Italian beauty Monica Bellucci, Sur mes lèvres, and the controversial Irréversible, as well as becoming everyone's favourite comedy Frenchman, with parts in films as diverse as Elizabeth, Birthday Girl, Shrek, Ocean's 12, and Derailed with Jennifer Aniston. Cassel now takes on his first role as producer in the somewhat bonkers French film Chaiton, in which he also plays a deranged housekeeper. I met up with one of France's most charismatic yet difficult stars while he was taking a break from filming with David Cronenberg in London. I asked him what his take on the film was.
It's a horror comedy more than anything else, I think. There is a lot of codes coming from all those slasher movies and things that we know, but on the way I think it really becomes something that you haven't seen a lot, honestly, I think.
Kind of genre-defying.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. I've always thought, because you're quite famous as a hard man of cinema, if you like, not a comedian as such, a comic, but whereas in this one you're quite funny.
Yeah, well, I hope so, because that's exactly what I was aiming, so... But, yeah, I've seen the movie with the audiences in theatre, and yeah, people really laugh. But it's... I think they laugh because it's embarrassing, situation-wise, and the way this guy in play, it's called Joseph, so it's this guy from the countryside, and he's very sympathetic, but a little too much, you know. He's on you. He wants to be so nice that you don't know what he wants, you know, and it gets to a point where, you know, you don't know how to get rid of him. And at the same time, you know, the way he approaches you, you just can't get rid of him.
I think English audiences, Vincent, they always think of you as almost an emblematic of multicultural Paris, that I presume from your debut that we saw here in La Haine. And I understand that your director, Kim, knew Mathieu Kassovitz, who directed you and wrote La Haine.
Yes, it's really strange because Kim and actually the rest of that collective called Court Rajmé are actually the direct sons of La Haine or Doberman, meaning that Kim in particular, he wanted to be a comic strip designer, is that what you said? And then he saw La Haine and he said, no, I want to be a director. And from that day, he just dropped the pen, you know, and the pencil and started to shoot videos.
You know, I think La Haine was perhaps one of the most important European movies of all time. And recently, Mathieu was back promoting its anniversary re-release. Yeah. Do you think that cinema in Europe, and particularly in France, has managed to recapture La Haine at any point? Or I think, in my opinion, it's still trying to catch up with the ferocity and explosive element.
Well, the thing is that I think it's very hard to do things on purpose. La Haine is one of a kind, you know, and I don't think there will be another La Haine, and why, you know, it's already there. About energy and about being specific on a subject matter and with the talent that goes with it, you know, I have the feeling that I've been part of like a movie like Irreversible, for example, for me is as important as La Haine. Maybe not socially, but artistically, definitely.
Yeah, I mean, I was at Cannes when that first screened, and I interviewed you then at a press conference, and people were sick and they were crying, and I just thought it was an extraordinary piece, and over time, we've come to see that how an important piece it is. Are you still reminded that, obviously, I mean, you're still living with Madame Bellucci, I think, and who is your actress in that film, and the two of you created... I think one of the strongest statements that European cinema has made in a long time.
Well, thank you very much. I'm not really, I mean, I don't know. But what I can say is that, to me, Irreversible was something I really had to do. You know, it's not really irreversible that I had to do. I had to work with Gaspar Noé. Because, let's face it, you know, a movie for me is very much about the director. You know, if you have a really good director... And that is a director that is possessed by. Then you have to be part of it, you know. And so Gaspar was in that state of mind when he did Irreversible, and actually Gaspar is such a pure artist that I think he's still like that today, and I just can't wait to see his next movie.
The irony is, I would have done these fantastic French movies, that probably most people in English-speaking countries will know you from your little turns in English-speaking dramas, such as Birthday Girl, I suppose, and perhaps even, what was that one that you did with Jennifer Aniston recently?
Derailed,
that's
Derailed,
the one.
Yeah.
When you get cast as the comedy Frenchman, though, in these kind of American movies.
You know, you discover an actor, like, in a movie, and if you like him, or if you like her, whatever, then you start to see other movies on TV. I say, oh, it's the same guy, you know, and but with the time, you know, you start to build kind of a knowledge of that guy. And that happened to me many times, you know, an actor you've seen in an American movie, say, oh, he's you know, Sacha Baron Cohen in Talladega Nights, or, you know, and then you see Borat, and you say, oh, man, okay.
They didn't ask you back for Ocean's 13?
I am in Ocean 13.
Oh, you are. I've just seen the trailer for it.
Yeah, but I'm just like, this time it's like really like a cameo.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All that lot, how old is that George and Brad and Andy Garcia? Do you get to hang out with all that lot?
Yeah, they're really cool. I mean, honestly, it's, you know, and plus, you know, strangely enough, even though it's looked at as like the most Hollywood thing ever, the truth is that Steven Soderbergh is such a different kind of directors, you know, that the director that you don't have the feeling of being on a big thing like that, you know, and they know each other, so there's always like an Ocean's Club on the set, so you can, you know, play cards, and it's a lot of fun.
Earlier this week, one of the finest British films of recent years was controversially awarded an 18 certificate by the British Board of Film Classification. Director Shane Meadows' 80s set This Is England is the tale of a young boy who's lured into a life of skinhead racial violence. I caught up with the film's producer, Mark Herbert, to find out more. Mark, your film This Is England has just been awarded an 18 certificate. Why does that annoy you?
A variety of reasons. I mean, if you look at some of the films that I've seen recently that have got not even a 15 but a 12 with 40 decapitated murders in them and stuff, then, you know, we've got a film that we feel has a very positive message, that we feel it's really important that kids see it. It's aimed at what the choices you make and bullying and peer pressure and how racist violence, when it's verbal as opposed to, you know, physical, is as bad. And to have it pulled because of those grounds just seems really, really galling. You know, we went to Rome Festival and it won the Audience Award, which was actually picked by under-16s, you know, and the message they got, the reason they picked it, was to do with they found relevance with it into contemporary society. We went to Berlin in the Generation 14 section, which is again aimed at teenagers, and in its own country of origin, it gets an 18.
So what have the BBFC said to you? Why did it get an 18 certificate?
Well, I've not actually spoke yet. I mean, at the moment, it's gone through appeal. Our distributor, Optimum, had appealed, and they came back and they've shown it to the whole board, and it's come back with the same results. So the process of appeal is over. But I just think that if you heard what the kids said that came in the rehearsals anyway, I mean, kids swear, you know, it's real life.
What were the offending scenes that you think has tipped it into 18 certificate territory?
I mean, I think that the end sequence, which, you know, I mean, there's very little violence in the film, actually, if you analyse it. It's mainly the threat of violence. And one of the things that we discussed in this is that to do with they quote the Sandu, the scene in the shop with Mr. Sandu. And, you know, we discussed that, and the use of those words were there to show how horrible it can be, you know, how sort of verbal attacks can be as hurting, you know, and problematic as physical violence. And just when we were making this film, there was a lad in Liverpool who was killed at the bus stop for his colour of his skin, and we were thinking, you know, we were trying to very deliberately sort of have a message that racism is complex. It's not a simple thing. It's a very complex issue. I'd love to just be able to sit down in a room and perhaps, you know, talk to them with other people, because in Glasgow, where in Dublin we've just been, we found out that, you know, some people want to use it in educational establishments. You know, I've got the Glasgow Film Festival really backing, and they couldn't believe that it was an 18, and they had to change a screening that they had today, because they were going to do a school screening today.
Mark, would you actually change anything to alter the certification?
I know exactly what Shane will say. Shane delivered his film, and that's the film he wants people to see. So no, I don't. No, we won't start to recut it or do anything like that or change the language.
Defiant to the last, Mark. Keep fighting.
Yes. Okay, Jason.
Cheers, mate.
Thanks. Bye bye.
Time for the famous Film Weekly competition now. Last week, we were offering you soundtracks from the film Hot Fuzz. We were also offering you T-shirts and special police notepads. We wanted to know which Oscar winner features in an uncredited and unrecognisable cameo in the film. The answers came flooding in from all over Britain, a peculiarly British enterprise, this one. The winner was Stuart Britton from Southampton, who says the Oscar winner in a cameo, Jason, was Kate Blanchett, who played Nicholas Angel's girlfriend Janine wearing a mask. Well done to you, Stuart. The prize is of getting an armed escort down to Southampton as we speak. This week we have a prize touched by the hand of Vincent Cassel himself. Yes, a signed poster and collector's edition of Irreversible, in which he stars with his partner Monica Bellucci and is directed backwards by the Argentine Frenchman Gaspar Noé. All you have to do is tell us three other husband and wife acting teams. That's three other husband and wife acting teams. Send your answer to podcasts@observer.co.uk and you can win a signed copy of Irreversible. Next week we'll be rifling through our Oscar goodie bags and taking off our makeup from the glamorous night in Los Angeles. We'll be having all the reactions to the red carpet event here on Film Weekly next week. I've been Jason Solomons. Film Weekly is produced by Paul Noble, and until then, happy viewing all night long at the Oscars.